presentation is actually a double presentation, taking up two slots, and it will be delivered by Robert Garrett and Andy McHugh, and they are going to tell us about Baseball Moving West, a 60-year retrospective.
Thanks very much for coming out, and it's an honor to be here. Thank you for the selection committee to give Andy and me a chance here. So basically, this idea for the presentation took place because of the 60-year anniversary by both the celebration by both the Dodgers and the Giants on their historic move to California. Now, up until that time, as everyone knows, the national game was confined to the northeast quadrant of the country. And so by moving out, Horace Stoneham and Walter O'Malley were really making the national game, the national pastime, geographically truly national. So we wanted to kind of talk about that idea and what happened in the California market and how the clubs managed in two different ways, really. They took two different trajectories once they made their historic move and they settled in. So we're going to be talking about that for a time, too. And I want to thank, from the outset, and Andy does, too, I want to thank Sabre for accommodating us to allow us to have this double session. It really helps us organize our material. Our modus operandi, if you will, is to have a tandem. We're going to be doing this in tandem so that I will start out with some basics and remarks, and then Andy will pass the baton, so to speak, and then Andy will vice versa, and we'll end up by talking about the long-term effects of the athletics general California sports market toward the end. So that is to give you a general idea that we won't be taking a break. We'll just be going through for two sessions with this back and forth business. So, okay, with that in mind, first of all, let's talk very briefly. And for this audience, I think we can go through the early material pretty quickly. I think most people here understand a basic sense of what was happening. We have to remind ourselves that the move west by both the Dodgers and the Giants was motivated by, one, the dissatisfaction with their current stadia, Ebbets Field in Brooklyn and the Polo Grounds in New York, and the promise of new facilities in a different area. The Polo Grounds, I'm going to concentrate mostly on the Giants story and let Andy fill you in on the Dodgers situation. But the Polo Grounds was in terrible condition for fan comfort, and Stoneham knew it. He had a wonderful 54 season and a miraculous World Series win. Many people, the Cleveland Indians were vastly favored, and the Giants surprised them by sweeping them, and Stoneham was elated. But he quickly realized in the 55 season that he was going to have to turn his attention not simply to the ball club he was owning and operating, but in fact to the place where he was playing. And the conditions there were rapidly deteriorating. If you look at the bottom slide, you'll notice more prominently than the top slide that the public housing was moving into that area, that the parking was decreasing rather than increasing. Stoneham had a prescient view that the automobile, post-World War II American, was going to be dominated by the automobile and people's use of it. And he saw a shrinking place for the parking and knew that with the white flight taking place in the 1950s, with people leaving their family, historically their immigrant neighborhoods in northeast cities particularly, and going out to the suburbs, they were going to have to come back in with their cars, and where was this going to happen, and so on. But in addition to that, in location, the idea of the area of the Polo Grounds was seen by many middle-class white fans as possibly a little, especially night games, as possibly a little dangerous to go to. And also the inside of the stadium, because it was so old, one of the oldest park in the game at the time, needed vast remodeling for it to come up to fan comfort. And so this was going to be cutting into Stoneham's already decreasing bottom line. So he was very interested in moving on. Now, despite being in the best market for baseball, the 1955, 56, 57 seasons for the Giants were dismal in terms of attendance. They were over a million in the 54 pennant year, but they decreased. They dropped off rather radically, and only a couple of small market teams. The Giants were third from the bottom in the National League in attendance. And Stoneham had his eye initially on not the West Coast, but rather his AAA farm team in Minneapolis, the Millers. And he and his vice president, Chubb Feeney, went out there often and under the guise of simply looking after the ball club. But in fact, they were really looking at the possibility of moving there with the City Fathers. And indeed, the City Fathers were quite interested. So he had a very clear idea that he needed to leave the city. And in fact, in a memo he sent to, in a conversation he had with Walter O'Malley in early 1957, he had decided to leave the city. And again, he was sure about his destination. He had a security there, but he hadn't made up fully that he was going to go and announce the date. Now, that's going to be very important because he's going to be wooed during that period of waiting and thinking by George Christopher, the mayor of San Francisco, and a number of people in San Francisco to get him out to the West Coast. Do you want to?
There are an awful lot of parallels, as you can tell by looking at this Ebbets Field site. It's bereft of, if it's parking. O'Malley had been concerned about it longer, I think, than Stoneham had. From the time he joins the Dodgers Board of Directors in 1945, he is constantly getting on his fellow board members that we need to do something about this stadium, build it out. That all doesn't really come out into the public until 1953. But he is pushing for it for a long time. And like the Giants, there are attendance problems. And if you look at this from right after World War II until he leaves, the Dodgers were an extraordinarily successful franchise during that period. They were in the World Series. They won a World Series. They were in playoffs twice. They lost another game, another season on the last day of the season to the Phillies in 1950. All of those great years, and yet attendance is going down. If you look at their competition, which is the black line, the blue line is going below that, and they are in the best market, the biggest market in the country. And so O'Malley is trying various things to try and bump up attendance. He's not getting the response from the citizens of Brooklyn that he thought he should, and somewhat despite the reputation for Brooklyn fans that they've have in more recent days. So he eventually tries to get leverage against the city of New York and the people who are getting in his way. He schedules the games in Jersey City. He sells the land under Ebbets Field. He's looking to try and prove to these people that he really is serious about maybe leaving the city. And let's remember that in mid-50s, New York is what we used to call the capital of the free world. And it is very, very difficult for anyone in New York to really believe that anyone is going to leave New York. And so O'Malley is looking for that piece of leverage that will convince them that he's serious. He doesn't create that. Robert Moses gets a lot of the blame, and he deserves a lot of the blame, but he doesn't deserve all the blame. There are certainly instances in which Moses is outmaneuvered on projects by people with the proper financing and the proper political support, and O'Malley is not able to rally that kind of political support. He gets a lot of support out of Brooklyn, but basically the other four bureaus really couldn't care less. So eventually, in late 1957, he finally strikes a deal. By the end of that summer, he'd kind of maneuvered himself into a hole. He didn't have a deal with the city of Los Angeles, which was procrastinating. They had made him a whole bunch of promises in the spring, and then found that they couldn't keep those promises. And at the same time, he has sold the land under his stadium in Brooklyn. He doesn't have a deal in New York. He doesn't have a deal in LA. He is dithering and dithering. Finally, the LA City Council offers him a deal, and the next day, whammo-bammo, he says, I'm going to LA in the fall of 1957, and the next year, they begin play in LA. And now to San Francisco.
In 1954, a great year for the New York Giants was also a great year for the future San Francisco Giants because the bond issue passed in order to fund a new stadium. George Christopher had that negotiating ticket in his hand when he was talking to Stoneham, or to Stoneham in New York. They didn't have locations yet, so for the first couple of years, the Giants had to play in a sub-major league facility for various reasons. It was Seal Stadium. And despite the fact that it was one of the jewels of major league of minor league baseball in the country, it was still not a major league facility. Nonetheless, they easily doubled their New York 1957 attendance, drawing 1,250,000. And the following year, 1959, the last year that they played in Seal Stadium, they drew an amazing 1,400,000, the highest total for the Giants in attendance since 1948, despite the fact that Little Seal Stadium seated less than 23,000, and of course the cavernous Polo Grounds had the ability to double that easily. So their attendance was extremely good because of the euphoria and the excitement of the fans and the city backing them and so on. But the real story of them coming was, of course, the promise of the new facility called Candlestick Park, named after a place 10 miles from downtown, south of the city, in land that was at least a third of it was underwater at the time, Charles Harney, the construction mogul, happened to own the land. And he had worked a number of shady deals. Many people feel there was a grand jury hearing on this later once the stadium site was picked, that concluded that the city really didn't get a fair deal. One contention was that Harney had bought the property, 50 acres of it, from the city of San Francisco in 1952 for $6,700 an acre, and he sold it back to the city of San Francisco in 1957 for $57,000 an acre. So this was a nice, he argued, of course, I had to do a little bit of bulldozing, but in fact, it was pretty much raw land. The good thing from the city's point of view is this was completely easy to work with. There was no problem of vacating neighborhoods, worrying about streets. This was one owner of a single unit of property that they could easily have. And the contention and the agreement was kind of hinged on the notion that Harney would be then the construction, his construction company would build the stadium. Now, he was assuming that it was going to be named Harney Park or Harney Stadium, and when the city decided to go to a general fan vote, San Francisco Examiner and the Parks and Recreation Committee agreed on this, and they came up with the name of the location rather than the name of a person. Harney took umbrage and slowed construction down, and that's a whole other side of the story. But the dissatisfaction with the park eventually was because of this snafu in construction that caused a lot of incidentals down the road to be attended to and add to the general problem. Now, there's a story that Walter O'Malley faced all the difficulties, and he's going to talk to you about this in just a minute. Walter O'Malley faced all his difficulties with his ballpark at the beginning of the construction, and that Stoneham had an easy run, and all of his problems came once the place was intact, and he suffered the fact of the weather and all of that. In fact, it was really from the beginning, Candlestick was a disaster. It was a disaster from the point of view of the mayor's office. It was a disaster from the point of view of the construction. It was a disaster, of course, from the location. And why did they do this? They wanted a quick fix. First of all, they wanted to get into a ballpark by 1960. They were delighted that they were going to be in there 2 years before the Dodgers got theirs. And it was all of this rush to judgment and rush to selection that gave them the problems down the road. So they moved in 1960. It was great fanfare. All of this, they had national figures come, and they opened the stadium, and settled in for some very, very good years, partly because they had a great ball club. And right away, the ball players saw the problems with the stadium. Before Mays ever played a single inning, he knew that it was going to be difficult for hitters going out in left field. Felipe Alou said that he used to fish in this place when he came up as a rookie, and he said the wind would blow his line all over. I mean, this was going to be a problem that the ballplayers sensed even before it settled in with the sports writers, who initially were quite happy, and then they realized that spending night after night after night, as Roger Angel once said, it was akin to an Inuit rite of passage to sit in Candlestick Park for an evening game. And eventually they caught on that if you could capitalize on this, people were wearing overcoats in the middle of July, of course, but they gave you a little quad to Candlestick, and I think many people, some people in this room proudly wear them on their hat. If you could survive an extra inning night game at Candlestick, you got one of these badges on the way out, so they were very aware of this. I can regale you with all kinds of stories about reactions to the weather. The famous story of Stu Miller is well known to everybody in this room. But I think my favorite is when they interviewed Jack Clark, who played right field and left field for the Giants, outfield for the Giants in the late 70s particularly. And they came up to him one day and said, what do you think about ways in which we can improve this? He said, yeah, dynamite. So,
As Rob intimated, the path in Los Angeles in the beginning was not as smooth as the San Francisco officials tried to make it. When O'Malley arrived in Los Angeles, he had the easy assumption that they were going to be playing in Wrigley Field, which was slightly larger than Seal Stadium and which the team owned. But he looked around and saw that, oh, obviously, Wrigley was even smaller than Ebbets Field by about 10,000 seats, and that it was in a neighborhood that wasn't real good. It was kind of going downhill. And he also saw the Coliseum. And it took him a while to negotiate it, but the Coliseum could hold badly, 93,000-plus people, and did. I should mention that 93,103 people at a game is a major league record still, and I am a co-holder of that record. Here he is. Part of the difficulties was his were really under, you know, despite O'Malley's reputation, he was remarkably naive about how Los Angeles worked and its politics. This is a shot of him getting off the plane in October of 1957, his first visit to Los Angeles after deciding he would move the team. The woman on the left side of the picture is Rosalind Wyman, who is a city councilwoman who was very instrumental in bringing the Dodgers in. So you can see the picture, and then you can see this picture, which is about 10 seconds later. Okay? We want the bums, but not the bum deal. O'Malley is shaking the hands with a man there. He's been given a summons for a lawsuit, supposedly by the people of Chavez Ravine. He asks Wyman, Rosalind, what is this? And Wyman says, don't worry, Walter, just keep walking, which he does. But there are all kinds of problems related to this, the working out an agreement. There is a small faction on the city council, which is very, very opposed and votes against every measure that needs to be taken to complete the deal in which the Dodgers get the Chavez Ravine property in return for the Wrigley Field property and some other promises. And eventually these forces that dislike the Dodger deal force a referendum to be held in June of 1958. O'Malley at first kind of ignores this and says he'll take the high road and we'll let the people decide. We know they're wise. But as things get down towards the end, he gets a little bit worried. And on the Sunday night before the vote, they stage what is called the Dodger-thon. And that is Joe E. Brown, the big baseball fan and Hollywood actor who's emceeing the show. And O'Malley was on the show pointing out the site and all the wonderful things the Dodgers were going to do. And they won that by a fairly narrow margin. The problem was that L.A. in itself was very divided. The downtown interests, the L.A. Times particularly, the big law firms, the big real estate firms, the big banks, they were all very, very much in favor of bringing the Dodgers in and kind of increasing the cultural capacity, so to speak, of the city. But Los Angeles, if any of you have seen a map of it, is really a monstrosity. There are ganglia that goes out here and there, and all of these people in the outlying districts really didn't share the downtown interest desire for this kind of thing. One of the big parts of LA is the San Fernando Valley. That spring, there had been a lot of rain for LA, I should say, and as a result, there had been a lot of flooding, and all of the schools in the San Fernando Valley had been closed for several days because work that is supposed to be done on storm drains and sewers had not been completed. And so people out there are saying, why are we getting tangled up spending $3 million building roads for the Dodgers when we can't even get our kids to school? And so that was a lot of source of the resistance to what was going on. But the Dodgers did manage to squeak through. Then they met up with Phil Silver. This is not Sergeant Bilko. This is a lawyer in L.A. who was determined to overturn the deal. As soon as the referendum passed, he sued. And it was a very interesting lawsuit because there was no disagreement on the facts, and there was no testimony in the case. Silver just said, the Dodgers are getting a public benefit. This private corporation is getting a benefit from the spending of public money and should not be getting so. And the judge ruled in their favor, a local LA Superior Court judge. That was immediately appealed to the California Supreme Court, who overturned the local judge by saying, yes, the Dodgers are getting a benefit, but in return, the city is getting a benefit of this land under Wrigley Field, and also another park that was to be built on Dodger Stadium property. So on balance, this is a reasonable deal for the city to make and cannot overturn the contract. And then later on in 1959, the Supreme Court declines to review the case, and so it stands in the Dodgers' favor. Now, of course, by looking at the dates, you can see that the Dodgers have lost 2 years. Those 2 years in which Candlestick was built, the Dodgers are fighting in court. Now, they're drawing a lot of people to the Coliseum, but they're not getting their stadium built. It doesn't really get going until 1960 and doesn't open until 1962. You can see here several construction pictures. It's a very interesting process. They basically built the stadium into the side of a hill, so a lot of the bracing and supports that most stadiums needed were not needed at Dodger Stadium. Now, this is the result, okay? You can see that they were declining. In 1957, they fall below what is the average of all of their competition. Then in 58, they burst above, stay above, and remain above. They have always been above the average of their competition since they moved to LA. So this has been very successful, and I think this is based on what I think of as the four S's in chronological order. One, Scully, a huge hit with everybody. Those of us, I was 9 years old when the Dodgers moved there. I have grown up and fallen asleep and done all kinds of things with Vin Scully in one of my ears. And I think that's true of most people in Los Angeles. The second S was success. They were a terrible team in 1958, and somewhat surprisingly and luckily, they won the World Series in 1959, which really cemented them. The town just wanted to go crazy over being major league, and especially in 1959, they got that. The third is the stadium. When it finally opened in 1962, it was widely appreciated. The third oldest stadium in Major League Baseball now, and people still really like it. I hate to say this, but it's probably not quite as good as AT&T or PNC, but it's still a beautiful stadium. And the fourth I would call sales, although really it's marketing. They are some of the most persistent marketers in the whole business and have been for a very long time. Other teams are starting to catch up with them now. But they were smart enough that in 1958, from the very beginning, they began broadcasting in Spanish and marketing to that market when nobody else was doing it. And they have continued efforts like that over the years, and it's resulted in a very strong connection between the community and the team. They can count on excellent attendance. Right now they are again leading the league in attendance per game this season, as they've done for I don't know quite how many seasons recently, but they are always right at the top. And despite their terrible television deal, which is annoying enormous numbers of people in LA, people are still going to the ballpark. And let me send you back to Rob.
Now, for the Giants' attendance, it was very, very good to begin with. In 1960, the excitement of the new ballpark, despite everybody realizing this is going to be a place where you really have to dress for the games, But the Giants had a very, very successful run from 1960 when they moved in there until 1968. I want to talk about that year in particular in just a minute. 1962, they had the wonderful and an eerie kind of playoff, reminding everyone of the 1951 playoff against the Dodgers. They same thing, and they're going three games, coming from behind in the ninth inning, and then the World Series played in Candlestick Park was, again, what Andy said happened in 59 in Los Angeles. This happened in 62 as well. And then for the rest of the decade, really, they played amazing baseball, coming in second five times from 1965 to 69, and fans went to the game. Now, in 1968, something changed. It was the beginning of the end for Horace Stoneham and for his run as the owner of the Giants in San Francisco and as a Giant owner in general. Charles Finley moves the Kansas City Athletics out to Oakland. Now, there were a number of people who were excited about this. Of course, sports writers in particular thought this would be fun to have another team to cover. But there were some people who said this is going to be a difficulty, and one of them was Horace Stoneham himself, saying that the Bay Area may not have the possibility of really having a fan base that could cover two teams. Sure enough, if you look at the attendance of the Giants and the A's combined over the next the rest of Stoneham's tenure, you'll see that they drew just about exactly what the Giants drew from 1960 to 1968, despite the fact that Oakland had such incredible early 1970s in Oakland. The baseball was tremendous there, and yet they did not draw really commensurate with their success, keeping both teams averaging about what the Giants averaged before the A's got there. Now, other things happened to Stoneham's organization. His players got older. He had to trade a lot of people, including the great Willie Mays, and that caused him a lot of difficulties. He also had a number of his close associates leave and go to different jobs, one of them his nephew and general manager, Chubb Feeney, who became president of the National League. But also, Stoneham himself was suffering from the decline, not only on the field, but of attendance. And in 1974 and 1975, the Giants drew abysmally. And in fact, there were a few games in 1974 and 75 that were under 1,000 for the ball game, prompting Herb Kane, one of the great pundits and writers in the San Francisco Chronicle, to acknowledge one day after seeing that the attendance had gone down to 750 for a game. He said, "I see that Horace Stoneham is planning Fan Appreciation Day at the end of the season. I wonder what he'll give him." Now, when Stoneham realized that he had to borrow money from the National League in order to meet payroll, he knew that he had to put the club up for sale, and that happened in 19... We're talking now, and one of the things I want to reinforce is the different trajectories. The Dodgers really starting cementing their... Andy was talking about how they really clicked with the community once O'Malley got beyond his difficulties. The stadium is truly what Jim Murray called it, the Taj Mahal of baseball, and they are really enjoying that success with good teams and so on. The Giants are going in the other direction. And ownership is once part of this. Stoneham waited and waited and waited for a local owner to come up. Nobody came, so he sold the team to Toronto. This was 11th hour, last minute, Bob Lurie coming, riding in, as you say, like the 7th Cavalry, and rescuing the team, keeping it in San Francisco. But he inherits Candlestick Park, warts and all. And he struggles now for the next 19 years to worry about the stadium, trying four times to get public funding and four times being defeated. And he then in 1992, am I getting ahead here of the slides?
No, you're right on.
Okay. He in 1992 sells the team to a group from St. Petersburg, Tampa Bay. Again, no local ownership stepping up. Knowing their conditions of the ballpark, they didn't want to really be saddled with this. And at the 11th hour, they cobbled together a lot of moneyed people, including Charles Schwab and Walter Shorenstein and Peter McGowan and the Gap brothers and so on, and they put together a coalition to put up the money, and now there are two buyers, if you will, coming before MLB, and they did not want to lose the San Francisco market. Peter O'Malley, Walter's son, was one of the great proponents of keeping the team in San Francisco because he wanted the rivalry to continue. And again, at the last minute, they managed to save the team, and Peter McGowan inherits, warts and all, Candlestick. Now, he was told at the time by Bill White, the president of the National League, but in fact vaulted into higher power because of the difficulties with the commissioner, Faye Vincent, who had lost a vote of confidence, that he took Peter McGowan aside and says, you've got to do something about your ballpark. I can't bail you out again. So McGowan knew his days were numbered, and he needed to get a new ballpark. He decided to do it, however, not with public funding because he watched the Lurie results. They were abysmal. Even the one in San Jose and Santa Clara, which would have taken the team still in the Bay Area but down the road a bit, and he decided to go with private funding. And it took 3 years of negotiating and building, but he made a beautiful success, hired an architect, and now we have the great, now AT&T, then Pac Bell, and the Giants' fortunes have changed dramatically. The relationship between the community is tremendous, and Annie's going to talk to you about sort of the effect of some of this in the Bay Area, but of course we know on the field as well, the attendance has just soared there in the top 3 to 4 in attendance of all of baseball since the park opened. So the success has totally changed because of the location. So I'll now pass it back to Andy and he can draw some conclusions.
We want to talk in this last section about the effects of the move on some broader issues. The first is on the communities of Los Angeles and San Francisco themselves. The second is on baseball in general. And the third is on professional sports even more widely. But here you can see the result of the building of AT&T as the attendance really shoots up and, more importantly, probably stabilizes at a very sustainable level. So in the communities, you'll remember the breakdown of the forces for and against the Dodgers that I mentioned to you. That was also the people who were supporting the Dodgers were people who had a very strong idea of making Los Angeles into a truly international city. They knew Los Angeles had a reputation of being kind of parochial. It was, you know, Hollywood and all the craziness there, but there really wasn't any more substance there. And the elites in Los Angeles really wanted to be able to say, we have the full range of cultural amenities. The Dodgers are one, but it's these same people who are supporting the construction of the Los Angeles Music Center, and all of that, the development of philharmonics and operas and all of those things that are really kind of the cultural frosting of a major city. And they were very successful in doing that and in changing the city, and the Dodgers were a piece of that. In San Francisco now, you can see how the current owners are leveraging their property. You can see AT&T Park in the middle. At the bottom, where that the black caption is land where they are now building a stadium for the Warriors, and this is becoming an integral part in reviving a neighborhood in San Francisco which had been very run down. So these are just some of the kind of community impacts they have. But let's look at what happened to Major League Baseball, since that's our major interest here. This is attendance from the end of World War II, going ahead until 1966, and as you can see, the National League establishes a strong hegemony in attendance. The green arrow indicating when the Dodgers and Giants moved, and there's a big leap ahead by the National League. There's that interestingly anomaly in 1961, which is a combination of, for some strange reason, every team in the National League except the pennant-winning Reds lost attendance that year. So they go down at the same time the Angels are created and the Twins. And so American League attendance leaps ahead. But then again, the next year, the American League is back behind and would stay that way, not just in 1966, but quite longer. And the interesting feature of this is that this is virtually all caused by the new markets on the West Coast for the National League. You can see the size of the gap in the early years. And then the American League begins to respond. And this is going to drive attendance and franchise relocation for almost the next two decades in baseball as the American League tries to close that gap. First, of course, is the Angels. We have the 1961-62 expansion, in which clearly the trade-off is that the American League will be allowed into Southern California and the National League will be allowed back into New York. And the American League really thought this was going to do them a lot of good. It did, but it didn't do what they thought. They didn't really grasp how cemented the Dodgers' relationship with the city of Los Angeles was. The Dodgers are playing in the Coliseum, which is a terrible place to play baseball, but is a real international stadium. The Angels in that first year are playing Wrigley Field, which is clearly a minor league ballpark. They then become a subtenant of the Dodgers in Dodger Stadium. They are, aside from a very interesting and fortuitous second year in 1962, they perform pretty much like expansion teams perform and like the existing owners want them to perform. They want to suck all the money they can out of the expansion owners and keep them down for a number of years, and they're very good at that. So the Angels never really establish a great deal of attraction. It has been now, I guess this is the 58th season when both of them have been in Los Angeles. The Angels have never outdrawn the Dodgers. And at the moment, the Dodgers, as they have for the last several years, are averaging 47,000 tickets sold a game. The Angels' capacity is 42,000. So the differential is likely to continue for a number of years. So next, we get, as Rob mentioned, the Oakland A's. And he's talked about their effect on the Giants and on the Bay Area market. What's interesting, of course, is that the American League had stopped Charlie Finley from moving to Louisville. They had stopped Charlie Finley from moving to Dallas. All of a sudden, Charlie Finley wants to go to the West Coast, and he can do that. They'll allow him to do that. They wanted some more of that market. And so he goes in there, and at that point, the leagues had no consideration for each other at that point, and so the Giants are left kind of dangling in the wind. But again, Oakland is in there. And again, for the American League, it's not as successful as they thought it would be, because the market just isn't big enough to really support two teams at that point. It also touches off another problem for the American League. They're being sued by the city of Kansas City. They're being threatened by Senator Stuart Symington of Missouri, who's going to go after their antitrust exemption, he says. And so they agree that they're going to put a team back in Kansas City. And while they've got the chance, they're also going to expand into Seattle so they can get some more of the West Coast market. The National League counters by agreeing to do the Padres. Now, this is more complicated because back in 1962, the American League had signed an agreement with the National League that neither would proceed with expansion without informing the other and discussing the consequences with the other. And yet here is the American League going forward on its own, doing exactly what it wants to do. The National League, which wanted to go into Seattle, counterattacks. There's a lot of recrimination and yelling back and forth. And then Senator Warren Magnuson and Senator Henry Jackson of Washington quietly let the National League owners know that they really want the American League to come into Seattle because the American League has already made that commitment. And so the National League goes quietly away, takes San Diego to get some part of the Western market as well. Both interesting, both West Coast teams, their leagues choose rather poor ownership groups. The Seattle Pilots are bankrupt within a year and wind up in Milwaukee. The Padres wait 2 or 3 years before C. Arnold Smith gets in trouble with the feds for tax evasion. But the team does, by the skin of its teeth, remain in San Diego. So guess what? This being the American League, they are now sued or threatened to be sued by the city of Seattle so that they have to accommodate a future expansion. They create the Mariners. The National League says, we don't want to go along anymore. We don't think we've absorbed the earlier expansions. So they stand pat. What's fascinating in all of this is while the American League is so focused on getting into the West Coast, they are leaving Toronto and they are leaving Dallas-Fort Worth. And Dallas-Fort Worth is a prize because Roy Hoffines has made it clear to the other National League owners that he's not going to accept any competition from Dallas. It's too good a media market for him, and he does sell some tickets there. So it's open to the American League, and finally Bob Short, rather than the league itself, moves to take advantage of that market. But both leagues, and the American League especially, are so focused on catching up with the attendance differential that the Dodgers and Giants have created in the late 50s, that for the next 20 years, all of their expansion decisions are greatly colored by their desire to get into more of the West Coast markets. So let me get rid of that just for a moment and recall to you, probably most of you can't remember what high-level professional sports was on the West Coast in 1957. It was 12 games, okay? The LA Rams played six home games. The San Francisco 49ers played six home games. That was it, 12 games. And yet, what the other thing that the Dodgers and the Giants move did was convince all the other professional sports that if they were going to be successful, they had to be on the West Coast. This is all of the professional football teams, good, bad, indifferent, many of them simply gone at this point. But every time somebody started a new league, they felt that they had to put a team into Los Angeles and into San Francisco, and it eventually extends, as you can see, clearly up to Portland and Seattle as well. It wasn't just football. Okay, one of the first teams to jump on it is the Lakers, who seem to be part of the LA firmament at the moment, but it wasn't until 1960, after the baseball people had really proved the market, that the Lakers moved into Los Angeles. And as with football, all of these other expansions and new leagues and everything else are heavily involved in getting franchises into the West Coast states. And hockey, the same thing. So this really represented a proof of the potential of the market and really a revolution in the spreading of professional sports franchises truly across the United States. And with that, I think we'll open it up to questions. You can address Rob or myself, either, whichever seems to fit your question. You don't have to applaud. It's all right. Don?
Yeah, I got a question for Rob. You didn't really talk about the A's too much. But they've had problems really all the time that they've been in the Bay Area. They've been talking about a new stadium for well over a decade. There's still no resolution. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I think that gets back to the idea of that split market. And we talked a little bit about how astounding it really was that they drew so poorly in the 70s, especially the early part of the decade when they had such great teams. But again, back to 2000 when the Giants moved into AT&T, or Pac Bell then, AT&T now, again, this was a swelling of the team. The Giants really took over the Bay Area, if you will, in such a great way. The other interesting conundrum here, and I don't want to get into this, it's another topic, but it's a good topic, is territorial rights. In order for Bob Lurie to go down to San Jose and get that vote, he called Walter Haas, at the time the owner of the Oakland A's, and asked him, did Walter have a problem with the Giants going down to Santa Clara? And he said, no, just go take Santa Clara County, you can have that. And that little conversation and subsequent exchange of letters was what MLB relied on four different times to establish that territory. So the A's lost out on that market as well. And of course, they were stuck with that stadium because then, you know, the Raiders kept, where am I going? The Raiders here or there, and they needed a tenant. So they were holding the A's to that agreement. And they've tried a lot of ways to sort of help that out. There is probably in the near future going to be some kind of new resolution of that regarding the stadium. But you're absolutely right. The A's, and again, good ball teams really over the years with world championships and so on. It's very strange stuff indeed, but the Bay Area, I think, is riveted towards the Giants, and the A's are the second team.
Okay, I guess I'll, for Andy, on the move in 1957, you implied that O'Malley really didn't make up his mind until October. But isn't it true that he had made it up a long time ago, especially since Stoneham announced in August that he was going to San Francisco? Would he have made that announcement if he didn't know that O'Malley was really going to LA?
That's kind of a hypothetical question. I, I believe from the research I have done that O'Malley steadily moved towards LA, let's say. When he first brought it up, say in 1955, it was nothing but an attempt to get more leverage, and it kept to get more threat. But as things worsened in New York and he got offers from LA, he slowly moved over. Now, when you're talking about the time in, I think it was actually July, when Stoneham made his announcement, I think O'Malley's preference by that time was to go to LA, but he didn't have a deal in LA, and he didn't have a deal in New York, and the people in Los Angeles were, frankly, as naive as O'Malley was about LA politics. They went to Vero, after O'Malley bought the Angels of the PCL in February of 1957, they immediately sent a delegation to Vero Beach, most important of the county supervisors, the mayor of LA, and some aides, and they went into to Vero Beach, and O'Malley would say, well, can you do this? And now he's a guy who's very experienced in how to run a stadium and how to make money doing it. The people from LA know nothing, and they want the Major League Baseball team. So everything O'Malley brings up, they say, oh yeah, we can do that. Sure, we can do that. And then they go back to LA and sit down with the city attorney and the county council, and all of a sudden they're being told, well, wait a minute, you know, you really can't do that. That's not legal. And so the terms that he thought he'd been offered in February for the next 4 or 5 months are steadily being ratcheted back. So yeah, he'd like to go to LA, but he doesn't have a deal, and he doesn't like the way the negotiations are going. So he holds off his final decision. I think he definitely has his preference by that point, but he hasn't made up his mind.
Thank you. I'll get to the question here. Obviously, the Dodgers and the Giants needed new homes in New York, and obviously the moves worked out well, particularly for O'Malley. I happen to think, though, that baseball as a whole was hurt very badly by the departure of those teams from New York, and that was a major reason why the NFL in the early 60s began to eclipse Major League Baseball as the nation's number one sport. So thinking about how this might have been handled differently, and either one of you can answer this if you have any data, why didn't the Boston Braves or the Philadelphia Athletics or the St. Louis Browns think more seriously about going to the West Coast instead of moving from one second-tier city to another? It really seems rather strange to me, and it seems to me that would have been a better solution for everybody in the end.
Yeah. Basically, it comes down to money, okay? Everybody could look and say, I'm sorry, sorry. Basically, it all comes down to money. The Braves, the Browns, who tried to move to LA in 1941,
yeah,
the A's and the Giants are all losing money. And you hear next to nothing today about how, you know, it was bad for them to move, or they deserted their fans, or da-da-da-da. You hear it O'Malley because he was making money, yeah, and he was. And I think you're right in the sense that I think the moves disillusioned a lot of people. All of us grow up, especially when we're kids, baseball, you know, it's wonderful, and, you know, it's our dad, and blah, 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 and we don't want to come to the terms with the fact that it's a business. And the move of both teams, especially the Dodgers, kind of drove it down the throats of people in the largest city in the country, yeah, and they didn't want to hear it. However, I would argue with you that by far, actually, the biggest reason for the emergence of the NFL was the idiot box. It's a perfect game for the television set, and baseball is a poor game for the television set. And as television spread, and as the NFL did such a wonderful job at getting its game on TV and promoting it, and the Major League Baseball did not do a good job of getting it on TV in the border, that to me is the key reason why there was a great, why the switch over to football.
One other comment on that, and he led me greatly there, so I appreciate that. In 1957, I would openly ask as well, what was the status of transportation in the United States when it came to air travel versus rail travel? The idea of traveling 3 days on a train to the West Coast, I don't think anybody wanted to do that.
Well, we'll start with the St. Louis Browns, way back before World War II. Okay, in 1940, Phil Ball knew that he was in just a losing situation in St. Louis. He decided he would move to Los Angeles, which had a junior of Chamber of Commerce, which was willing to guarantee him 500,000 in attendance for the year. And to Phil Ball, that looked great. That was like four times what he was drawing in St. Louis. So he sat down in 1941 with all of the big railroad companies and the, at that point, fledgling national airlines, and he worked out a schedule that could accommodate his team being in Los Angeles. And he shared that with the other owners in the American League and got the impression, definitely from them, that they would approve his move to Los Angeles. So when the winter meetings were about to begin, Phil Ball goes to Chicago for the annual meeting, and they're going to start on a Monday. And on Sunday, he goes to see the old Chicago Cardinals, who've moved twice since then, play a football game at Wrigley Field, I believe. And, sorry? It was a Comiskey? Okay. And during the game, the announcement comes on that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor. And Phil Ball and all the other American League owners knew that it was not going to fly. So it had been established in the minds of many of the owners that you could deal with the schedule problems. It wasn't going to be smooth or easy. And 20 years later, in 1958, it was going to be a lot easier because you had the Constellation and the DC-6 and the DC-8 who were capable of those longer flights. And nobody was talking about train transportation out to the West Coast anymore. So I think those issues had been pretty much dealt with, first of all, by World War II and the development of the aviation industry. It had just taken Major League Baseball a while to kind of get off its butt and really move to the West Coast.
Okay. Speaking of planes,
I just wanted to add one other note to Andy's remark, that 1958 was the beginning of commercial jet travel. That helped. Also, if you look at the schedule, very interesting, 1958 baseball season, the Giants and the Dodgers hosted teams for five-game series. And so there'd be 10 games. Let's just say the Phillies come into town in San Francisco, they play five. They go down to Los Angeles, they play five. So this was a way of addressing that concern about travel. Although by the end of the season, with jet travel coming in, and Andy's mentioning the other form, it was a non-issue for the 59 season as well.
Were the Dodgers one of the first teams to have their own plane?
Yes.
And was that a result of the fact that they were distant from all the other teams, or was that just a smart maneuver on their part to have their team be more relaxed?
O'Malley had actually bought it when they were still in Brooklyn, and it was not capable of flying to the West Coast without a couple of refueling stops. So for the early years in L.A., that plane was used to haul around Montreal and St. Paul. Rather than the Dodgers themselves. And then he got himself a bigger plane, and things were smoother after that.
And the first DC-8 flight was in 1957 or something like that, right?
Yeah.
The first transcontinental nonstop flight, wasn't that right around then?
Right. And it was the right time. But one other thing I should mention that's kind of related to that is that the other National League owners were very worried about what was going to happen on the West Coast. And Rob and I have talked about this, and we know for certain that the Dodgers, and we're pretty sure the Giants, were forced to guarantee all the other teams in the National League that they would make at least as much money on their road trips to the West Coast cities as they had the year before. And the Dodgers paid a couple of teams a very small amount of money, and everybody else made more in L.A. than they had in the East.
And how were gate receipts split in those days, do you know?
No, I can't recall. Yes, sir.
I'm just wondering, you mentioned that this is the 60-year anniversary, and I want to ask you personally. 60-year anniversary of the move out west. Horace Stoneman is almost never talked about compared to Walter O'Malley. Can you assess Walter O'Malley's legacy today compared to when it moved 60 years and how it's changed over the years and what the final verdict is on the move to Los Angeles, whether it was the right move or not?
There's quite a bit to that question. It would require, I think, maybe a whole Saber conference.
And a moral judgment.
Yeah, definitely Stoneham, and I think this is a matter, Andy and I have talked about this over and over again, I think it's a matter of personality too. The two men were vastly different in personality, and Walter O'Malley was a public figure and Stoneham was more in the background. So there's that to be said. But keep in mind that Stoneham was more, he made up his mind quite early, talked to Walter O'Malley and said, I'm moving. He was blunt about it. You can check that. It's early 1957. And then in the Seller hearings on baseball in July, he admits to the committee that he's moving to San Francisco once the agreement with San Francisco is complete. So he's out publicly, and as far as the legacy is concerned, I think both men now, there's enough out on both men. Walter O'Malley, of course, is well known about this, but I think there's more and more coming about Stoneham that suggests that these two men were really pioneers in this historic, both of them making an historic leap, really, leaving that great market and coming out not knowing exactly what was ahead and doing it, and the results, I think, stand in their favor.
Dennis? Yes. I went to a Sabre meeting a couple years ago in New York City, and there were something to do with the New York Giants, and the baseball team was there. But a lot of the Giant hierarchy are trying to get Stoneham in the Hall of Fame. I've written a book on the Hall of Fame. O'Malley's in there. They're trying to get Stoneham in the Hall of Fame. So I just wanted to mention that.
That's another subject that you hear a lot about. His achievements, I think, he and Bill Veeck founded the Cactus League. He signed Masanori Murakami, opening the game to a global, 1964, the first owner. He effectively broke baseball's second color barrier with the Latinos coming in so clearly in the 50s, and Alex Pompez working, the first minority to be in the front office of any major league team. That's all Stoneham. Not to mention the West Coast thing. I mean, second major, National League owner to sign African American players and all of that. So I think there's much you can line up. I'm not a voter. I don't try to get into these conversations, but I think there's a lot of merit to your point.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I'm not prepared to make a moral judgment on either of these guys, but I think the impact of what they did is extremely clear. We touched on it a little bit, especially at the end of this presentation, but Los Angeles had been the third largest city in the country since the 1940 census. San Francisco was, I think, seventh or eighth in that range. And everybody knew that sooner or later, Major League Baseball was going to have to go to the West Coast. In the late 40s, the PCL had made an unsuccessful attempt to try and get itself recognized as a major league and to convert into such, and they had failed at that. But the major leagues, basically from the end of World War II until O'Malley and Stoneham moved, dithered. I mean, if you look at the sporting news, it seems like every week there's an article about, well, do we add a new league? Do we expand? Do we go to 10 teams? Do we go to 12 teams? Do we promote the PCL? All of these ideas are floating around, and nobody's doing anything. And finally, Stoneham and O'Malley bite the bullet, and they move. And that changes everything. Thank you very much. For those of you interested, Rob and I will be signing at the Nebraska table 9:30 Saturday morning.